So today we're going to be starting a series in Isaiah that will take us from now through to Easter. And we're going to be looking at a particular section of Isaiah, right? Isaiah pretty neatly divides into three distinct sections, and this is the second of them. Begins at chapter 40 and goes through chapter 55. And today we're going to be looking at the first chapter of that section. And I'll say right off that I expect that some of you will be very frustrated that I pass over some very famous verses that we could spend weeks on. The reality of Isaiah 40 is that there are all kinds of pieces in Isaiah 40 that become incredibly important in the New Testament. In all seriousness, we could easily spend a couple months just in Isaiah 40 seeing the way that different ideas pull ideas going way back to Exodus, and then how those ideas get picked up in the New Testament. But that's not what the kind of the goal of this series is. So I exercised extreme restraint trying to look at what the whole chapter is about. So if I pass over something that would just have you lathered up in excitement, please understand that I'm all lathered up inside too as I pass over it. So, in any case, we're going to be looking at kind of the big picture questions here. As you know, well, some of you who know me better, I believe one of the places where evangelical preaching and teaching has failed in the last 100 years is that your average evangelical believers know the verses inside out, but don't know the big themes, don't know the big, you know, the big messages of books as a whole. So that's where I tend to emphasize. So in any case, the pressing matter, right, the burden or the question, the core thrust of the whole book of Isaiah is basically, how can Israel ever be what Israel is called to be? Okay? God had given this particular people unbelievable, literally unbelievable promises that he would bless the entire world, making all things right, and that he would do it by blessing them. That he would bless them so that they would then be blessing to the world. But he had also warned them that the blessings come through obedience to his will, and he had warned them that their disobedience would bring devastating curses down on them. Okay? So both of those themes return again and again all through the first 39 chapters of Isaiah. We have scathing denunciations of Israel's sin with warnings that their destruction was imminent. But we have those warnings side by side with promises that the son of David and the root of Jesse would appear any day to bring about all those promised blessings. Some have said that with these two themes keep going back and forth, and with no reconciliation between them, that if the original Isaiah of Jerusalem in the 8th century BC, if he had only written the first 39 chapters and stopped, then what he wrote makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, because these two themes appear irreconcilable. Israel is the incurable, seething mass of wounds described in chapter 1. Why should I beat you any longer? You don't learn. Right? Israel is either that mass of wounds that cannot learn, that cannot be obedient, that because they have eyes but will not see and have ears but will not hear, the people that can only bring curses down on themselves until they are destroyed. Or they're the chosen people of God of chapters 9, chapter 11, the people of the Messiah, who, because they know God, will bring the world to know God. But how can Israel be both? To borrow an important word from the chapters of Isaiah that we'll be looking at, how does Israel, chosen to be God's servant actually become God's servant when they are hopelessly disobedient and under a curse. So a little bit of the historical context of Isaiah. At the beginning of Isaiah's ministry, the kingdom of Judah was under the under King Ahab. And under King Ahab, they were tested. Judah, which is the southern country there in the dark blue, was attacked by Israel, their northern brothers, in the kind of the dark pink, who was much bigger than Israel. In this particular map, they look about equal, but in actuality, Israel was always the much bigger, much more powerful kingdom. So when Israel was aligned with Syria in green, which on this map is with their other name, Aram, and Syria was much bigger than either Israel or Judah, okay? So Judah was being attacked by these two northern kingdoms, both of them much more powerful, and they had aligned to conquer Judah, most likely to bring Judah into a forced coalition to oppose the rising power of Assyria. But whatever the reason, when they were attacked by Syria and Israel, Isaiah called on Ahab to not react like all the other nations of the world and look for powerful partners, but to trust God. Because Israel was called to be God's servant and to be his demonstration of his faithfulness. Trust in me, I will deliver you. You will be unlike every other nation, and in that, the nations will see who I am. And under Ahab, Judah utterly fails, just exactly like they always have. And instead of trusting God, they reach out to Assyria for protection from Syria and Israel. And exactly as Isaiah warned Ahab, Assyria does defeat Judah's enemies, but then Assyria goes on to crush Judah itself and bring Judah under its power. Okay? We often think of Judah kind of surviving the attacks from Assyria, but Jerusalem itself was eventually spared, but the country of Judah was destroyed by the Assyrians. So from there, from that first testing of Ahab in the beginning of Isaiah, from there, the book of Isaiah is all lessons about the trustworthiness of God, right? Teachers nowadays will give the pretest and then teach the material and then give the post-test, right? Ahab was the pretest. They failed miserably. And then there are all these lessons through the 39 chapters of Isaiah about God's faithfulness, about what it is that he wants them to do by trusting him, and how the difference between trusting God or trusting the nations and their idols is the difference between being used by God to demonstrate who he is to the nations or not. And then that culminates in a second big test. So over those years, from being Ahab's rescuer, Assyria has become the new enemy in the time of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah faces this second test. He faces the same test, right? Just as Ahab was attacked, now Hezekiah is attacked. What will he do? Will he trust God? Or will he trust, like Ahab did, all the usual sources of power that all the other nations trust? And Hezekiah appears to succeed. He puts his trust in God, essentially because he has no other option. There is no one else to cry out to. And God is faithful, miraculously delivers him from the Assyrians. But then we are immediately given a glimpse that Hezekiah has not actually learned anything. If you know Isaiah well, you know that immediately after the Assyrians are defeated, emissaries show up from the Babylonians. And Hezekiah is very, very quick to enter into partnership with the Babylonians, basically forging an alliance to shore up his protection against Assyria. Judah has not learned to trust God. Judah continues to do things the same way as all the nations around them. They cannot, they will not learn. And because of this, Isaiah announces to Hezekiah that all his kingdom will go into exile, and they will serve the king of Babylon. You chose your master, you get it. And in a final demonstration that the concern for God's glory that was so beautifully expressed in Hezekiah's prayers for deliverance from the Assyrians, I mean, they're moving things that Hezekiah prays when he's facing the Assyrians. But in his final display that it was about that deep, when Hezekiah is told about the coming destruction of his kingdom and that his people will go into slavery for their disobedience to God, his response is, well, yeah, okay, whatever. As long as it happens after I die. This is the servant of God. This is God's chosen people through whom he will glorify his name. No wonder it is said that my name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. This is the kingdom that's supposed to show the world what God is like? This, Hezekiah, this is the greatest king since David of the house of David? Where there's nothing left whatsoever that resembles David's heart for God? And that this house is somehow going to produce the king that's going to change the world? How does the servant become the servant? So I believe, as I kind of wrote this week, that all of these chapters were written long before Judah went into exile. And that one of the reasons this prophecy about the return from exile was given even before that exile happened was so that as Judah continued to decline for the next 200 years or so before the Babylonian exile. As a lot less than 200 years, 180 or so, 120 or so, off the point. As Judah continued to decline and bring more and more of the curses on themselves, as they prove in their experience that God has rejected them as his people, that they would be equipped with a glimpse of the larger hope, that even if they were utter failures, God's plan for them would still succeed. Okay? Even as they see the reality of the exile barely poke over the horizon, and then grow and grow and grow until it just blots everything else out and the full curses come down upon them, that all throughout that process, they would still know that God will still be faithful to what he has said. And why? Because of who he is. How can the disobedient, worthless servant become God's servant through whom he accomplishes his purpose for the world? Because God is who he is, okay? And so this first chapter of this whole section announces the theme of the eventual return from exile. But what the chapter is really about is who God is. So we're going to read through it. It's on the long side. As we go, I'll just kind of point out the major points that are being made as we go. So in the first section, Judah is all that's left of Israel. And Judah is being told that even though Hezekiah and the kings after him will bring exile upon them, there will still be a time when their God will return to them and fulfill his promises. Not because they have learned their lesson, not because of their worthiness, not because they've turned a corner, but because of his faithfulness. So this is the first nine verses. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all mankind together will see it. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. A voice says, cry out. And I said, what shall I cry? All men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall. But the word of our God stands forever. You who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good tidings to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up, do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. God will return to them, but it's not because they've become faithful. They are still the grass. It is only because his word is sure. And then we have a long section, most of the chapter, which is simply describing who God is, describing what God is like. We're first told about his power. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. And then we have his compassion. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms. He carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those who have young. We're told about his wisdom. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales, or the hills in a balance? Who has understood the mind of the Lord, or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? Or who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? And then we're told about his majesty. Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They're regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon, which was at the time was a famous forest, kind of like the Amazon we would think of today. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him, all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. And then, having described what God is like, Isaiah compares God with the gods of the nations, right? The lifeless idols of wood or metal. To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? As for an idol, a craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. And then in contrast to these things that are merely the creations of people who pray to them, we're then shown that God is the utter opposite, not a creation, but the creator of all things. This is from verse 21. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground than he blows on them and they wither. And a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal? Says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name, because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. And then we have the question that drives all of Isaiah. If this is who God is, what will we do? Will we trust him? When things are as bad as they possibly get, and Isaiah, whether we look at the beginning of his prophesying, or whether we look at the end of his ministry, or whether we look past his life at what he foresaw, it was as bad as it can get. When things are as bad as they get, and Isaiah is seeing in his prophecy the worst possible, will his people say, God has given up on us. We're on our own. Time for us to figure out some other method. Or will they say, God will see us through and will use this to fix our problems, even if we are the problem? When things are just as bad as they will be, how will Israel respond to who God is? This is from verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Right? God has given up on us. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. The word of God for the people of God. So at the end there, it's all about the question, where will you put your trust? And in that context, it's really interesting to note that those wonderfully poignant and famous last verses about eagles' wings and running and without tiring, they're not presented as a reward for trusting God. Okay? And it seems to me that people often seem to take those things that way, right? That it's some transactional process, that we do what God wants, we honor him by trusting him, and in a reward for that is he's going to make us feel young and strong and in control, and like we can just go do anything like superheroes, right? Marvel Universe, here we come, right? All you have to do is trust God. So I'm trusting, trust harder, right? That's not at all what's being said here. What is saying, these verses are saying that God is a trustworthy source in which to trust, right? When you enter hard times and you know that you will need strength and comfort and support, where do you look for it? And what it's saying is that if you look for anything, if you look for that supply anywhere other than God, it will turn out to be false. It will dry up. It will not provide what you look for. It will be ice that looks solid, but you walk out and clink, you're wet. Whereas God, you're not going to feel strong. You're not going to see yourself soaring high above the earth, far of 30,000 feet above your troubles. You're going to be in the midst of them, feeling cursed by God himself. But as you trust God, you will find what you need to make it through. The ice will look treacherous, and every step you'll think that I'm going through on this one, but somehow it will hold. The famous verses here about mounting up on wings and renewing our strength are simply saying that those who put their trust in anything but God will find themselves betrayed by what they trusted, while those who trust in God will find that he comes through for them. And this is true even as they go into exile under his curse for disobedience to him. So like I said at the beginning, this chapter is full of famous bits and pieces. But when we put them all back together as a whole to see what the chapter is doing, the chapter is really all about who God is and the fact that there is no one like him, and that his power and his wisdom are infinite, so that every word of his is absolutely sure, so that the only reasonable thing to do is trust him absolutely no matter what, even when he appears to be your enemy, destroying you. We face all kinds of hard things. Not what the people of Isaiah's time saw. But we face all kinds of hard things. There's always something in the present, and to be a little bit dour, none of us know what's happening, right? We stand on the brink of a new year. And we can look back and say the last couple years were really hard, so this one's got to be better, but we don't know that. And in all of these things, we know, because we've been taught and we've accepted and we've made a decision that this is what we're going to believe, we know that God is the answer and that we are called upon to trust him. And we try to do that. But what do you do when a lot of those hard things are things that you know you have brought upon yourself? With bad decisions, even with willful sin. What if those hard times feel like God punishing you? And for all of the verses that you can quote about God will not punish us according to our sins, it still feels like God is punishing you, and you know that he would be right to do so. How do you then turn to him to ask for deliverance when you know God is just holding you accountable? How do you ask for deliverance when you know that a wise God would not deliver you until you learn your lesson? And that the difficulty should really only end when you straighten out. And at the same time, you know that you've done everything possible to try and straighten out, and there's no hope of you ever straightening out. If curses are for disobedience and blessings are for obedience, if obedience itself is the blessing, right? And that's important to recognize. There's no possible blessing without obedience, because the blessing, it looks like obedience, right? It's simply doing things God's way. But if curses are for disobedience and blessings are for obedience, how do we, disobedient by nature, receive the blessings that God has sworn to deliver? How do the people of God become the people of God? How does the one called to be God's servant actually become his servant? That's what this whole section is going to be about. And it's going to go into some detail later. But here at the beginning, the big answer that overarches all the details is that it's not in us. It's not in our being better or learning our lesson or repenting more deeply or more sincerely or having more faith or anything else that comes out of who we are or what we manage to do. In the most absolute sense, it is not in us. The answer comes out of who God is, the one with infinite wisdom, infinite power, and infinite compassion to bring about the good that he made us for. The rest of the chapters in this section of Isaiah are going to go on and say a lot about the servant of God. And first, we're going to have descriptions of what it was that Israel was called to be when God called Israel to be his servant. And then we're going to have descriptions of just how badly they failed. And then the second half of this whole section is going to go deep into the question of how the servant can become the servant. And the answer is yet another servant. But before we get into those details, again, this chapter stands as a larger framework around the whole question. Is it possible that Israel can be turned around when history had already proven conclusively that they were incapable of learning to trust God. The only thing they could do was bring curses on themselves. Can God ever have a special people who know him, love him, and obey him so that he can work through them to do his will in the world? And the answer is yes, because God is incomparable in power and wisdom, and he has said that he will use his people to bring blessing to the world. Amen.